This episode, I'm joined by philosopher Joseph Acquisto to discuss his book, Living Well with Pessimism in 19th Century France. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support the podcast going into 2024, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Joseph Acquisto, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Pleasure. Great to be here.
We are going to be discussing your 2021 book, Living Well with Pessimism in 19th Century France, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan, who I should say were kind enough to gift me a copy, so a big thank you to them. And as people will imagine from the title, this is a book on pessimism, on drawing on Schopenhauer, drawing on poetry, drawing on, very refreshingly, aspects of pessimism which I would say, just from my own reading of the book, which I thought was great, move away from a very stereotypical view of pessimism as a notably drudgerous, rainy pastime, if you want to put it that way, and you incorporate these elements of humor and, once again, of poetry and tragedy, which was extremely refreshing, especially in relation to Schopenhauer, which I'm looking forward to getting through to. But before we begin talking about the book, just tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is you do, and you know, why did you write a whole, well, many books now on pessimism and notably pessimistic thinkers?
Yeah, I'm a professor of French and director of the School of World Languages and Cultures at the University of Vermont in the United States. And this book on pessimism is something I had been thinking about for quite a while. I'm intrigued, as you said, by the fact that for most people it's a dirty word. It's something you, or a social problem, or something to be avoided or corrected somehow. And also the misconception that pessimism is affiliated with the notion of things just simply going badly. And as you said, you know, an unnecessarily bleak way of looking at the world. That's never the way I understood it at all, either at a personal or intellectual level. So I began to think about the ways it was represented historically, both in nonfiction and in fictional texts. It very quickly became, for me, an epistemological question, because to be able to say something about the world along the lines of, you know, things will go badly or things will go well implies a certain knowledge about the world that we may or may not have. And so as I got deeper into this, it became that epistemological question of what can we know and what can we affirm based on what we know, which led me to literature, something we can maybe talk about a little bit later, the distinction between verisimilitude, or, you know, a true seemingness, or verifiability. So very quickly, these led me to literary questions, where the questions of narrative, come to the fore in a very important way in terms of ways of understanding the world through story, through literature, through representing the world. Mm-hmm.
So I guess in a way, I have to ask before we go on, are you a pessimist? Would you consider yourself a pessimist?
I am, yes, and that's part of the goal of the book. It offers what I call an interhistorical reading. It's concerned with 19th century France, but my argument is that if we are interested still in 19th century France, it's because these questions and a lot of the answers are still very much with us and valid for today. So in the introduction and the conclusion of the book, I do attempt to make a case for the continued relevance and to argue for this position rather than maintaining a cool analytical distance at all times in what I'm doing.
I see. So I like to ask questions which really just completely, you know, open up the floor. And really, in a way, this is the beginning question, I think, of your book, which is what the definition of pessimism is, because you very quickly, as we sort of already mentioned, you know, I guess in a way, I'm almost asking you to define two things, because it's a question of, well, what do we often define pessimism as? But then how do you reformat that and sort of not change it? I don't think you alter it, but you open it up. So what are these two definitions, I guess, of pessimism?
Yeah, for me, pessimism turns around three axes, so maybe sort of three keywords: lucidity and solidarity and meaning. So lucidity in terms of the reality of human suffering and injustice, a certain wariness for either oversimplistic or unjustifiably optimistic views of the world, which I would argue often result from simply not being willing to consider or be reminded of the suffering of the world, to convince ourselves that the world is more like we prefer to imagine it as opposed to the way it really is. I think this has something to do with a modern worldview, which is something we can talk about later, perhaps. But also, I don't know if this is the case in Britain as well, but certainly an American perspective that always likes to put a cheery face on things and to enact what Lauren Berlant has called a cruel optimism. So lucidity, solidarity then among human beings in the face of human suffering. And this is where it gets interesting in terms of questions of resignation from the world, whether we should simply resign ourselves and step back and attempt to live simply privately. I think some people associate that with a more common, common definition of pessimism. But again, if we accept the reality of human suffering and a certain universality of human suffering, that really is a call for solidarity based on that among human beings, and an attempt to alleviate suffering to the degree possible without having any sort of confidence about being able to overcome it, but still to attempt to make things better within a narrowly defined set of limits. And then finally, finding meaning in the world, maybe despite the suffering or through the suffering, to attempt to find, to assign meaning to our individual and collective experiences. And that's again where I see an important link between philosophy and literature, that both in some sense are invested in assigning or finding or most often creating meaning that will allow for a livable reality.
So, I mean, there's a couple of comments there. I mean, I just want to throw in that, you know, you mentioned whether or not it's the case in Britain, you know, that we're much like your Americans. I think this very modern, as you've said, American infectious optimism has very much become sort of a parasite here. But I don't think, you know, our national character, I don't think we can just about uphold it. We still have a sort of love of being miserable and you know, moaning about everything. So, you know, naturally pessimistic, I guess. But I mean, so it seems there's a kernel of pessimism there. Well, there's three, as you've mentioned, but they all seem to center around the, you know, like something that you can't avoid, which is suffering. And so do you think that question of epistemology of, you know, how do we know what we know, sort of springboards off the fact, you know, okay, what's the thing we can't avoid? Well, like it or not, we are all suffering, and this avoidance is trying to avoid the fact that we die, that we suffer, that life is, in my own opinion, and that of many pessimists, and maybe yourself, is by and large suffering, as Schopenhauer would argue, is the positive force of the world. Do you think the epistemological question begins from, okay, we're suffering, now what?
Exactly. Yes. And there's, in the book, I mentioned the fact that you can buy any number of items of merchandise now that say if you find the glass half empty, get yourself a smaller glass and stop bitching. And I think that's meant to be a critique of pessimism. But ironically, that actually is an excellent formulation of the pessimist worldview, as I understand it, not that it's to be complaining, but to adjust one's sense of limits or expectations in a way that would allow for comfortable living within that set of limits, within that critique that is implied by the thing you can get on a coffee mug or a print or whatever, is actually a very strong endorsement of pessimism, as a lot of my authors that I talk about in the book understand it.
But there's only so far you can lower your standards.
This is true.
So, I mean, there's a clear question here, I think, that needs to often with pessimism, with this form of philosophy, that often, you know, people, there's a conflation. And we need to bring in this thing of nihilism, and in a way, I think also antinatalism now starting to get more of a look in. And I think, you know, we were speaking about Jerome before we started recording, and, you know, of course, Schopenhauer, and name any pessimistic author, you often get nihilism or nihilism as a sort of a thrown at them. And I would say, just personally, I don't think I've yet to find a true nihilist philosopher. Maybe Mindlander. But you know, what's the difference here? I mean, of course, you've already mentioned it because meaning is one of your three kernels. But what is the difference here between pessimism and nihilism?
Yeah, meaning, I think, is a key element to distinguish from pessimism. The affirmation on the pessimist side that we can, in fact, find meaning in the world, that it doesn't necessarily shut down or cancel any attempt to live well in the world. And my title plays, obviously with that notion of living well in terms of the traditional philosophical question of what does it mean well to live well in the world, but also our modern sense of the phrase living well with usually is followed by an illness, living well with cancer, living well with depression or something like that. So, to say that one, despite what we might know or affirm about suffering, to not simply reduce experience to that, to not reject, as you said, a certain ability to find humor in the situation, or an ability to adjust one's expectations in order to live a perfectly fulfilling life in ways that I think nihilists would reject. I would also say that pessimism is anything but a static category. I think there's I would say the same thing about cynicism, or even sort of some religious responses to suffering in the world. They tend to be a fairly static response, in that one has identified one solution or one explanation, and one is content to leave it there, as opposed to pessimism, which I think opens more questions than it answers. That's something I argue about Schopenhauer, that by even through his wanting to account systematically for suffering in the world, he ultimately poses far more questions than he answers, in a very exciting way, precisely because that's where dialogue happens. That's where the question, the work of interpretation and attempt to find meaning occurs. So I think pessimism opens those doors, whereas nihilism would have a tendency to close them.
Mm. Okay. I mean, just before we get to Schopenhauer, is so key for your book, you mentioned their cynicism, and it's something I've been thinking about recently, actually, in relation to sort of the original cynic Diogenes. You know, this notion of living in such a way that throws in the face of everyone the values that you're surrounded by of your society, and much fluxing in the same way as pessimism changes, cynicism changes. The question I'm asking myself today is whether or not Diogenes, what would he have to do to upset the people of today who seem to not have any values? What can you do in that case? Do you think pessimism has a relationship of becoming with the values which are constantly fluxing?
Yeah, I think so. And pessimism is, in some senses, a modern category, but in other senses, obviously, it goes back to the ancient world and to certain currents. It has a family resemblance with certain aspects of cynicism, stoicism, what has been labeled melancholy or depression. Obviously, there are family resemblances there. The word pessimism itself, though, it is in fact a modern invention. It entered in French in 1759. It first meant mental disposition. It was defined as a mental disposition, and then in 1819, a second definition was added as pessimism as a doctrine. Pretty much directly related to Schopenhauer's ideas, which was interesting because Schopenhauer was not very well known in France until much later in the 19th century. He was translated only in little bits and fragments, and a complete translation of the world as well and representation didn't come about until much later in the 19th century.
So pessimism was just in, do you think it was just in the air, something? Do you think maybe it was a reaction to, the increasing reason and rationality of the day?
I do think that, yes. And reason, rationality, and a certain faith in reason and rationality that has everything to do with a narrative of progress, that, a narrative of progress, and also a linear notion of time. Another major work on pessimism, Joshua Foadeenstag's book, talks about pessimism initially in terms of varying conceptions of time as opposed to cyclic, as opposed to linear time. And with the notion of rationality comes this belief, absolutely akin in many ways structurally to a religious belief in progress. I think pessimism comes to trouble that notion, or at least call it into question as, you know, an affirmation of paradoxically faith in reason. I don't think it's any coincidence that it arises precisely at that moment of mid-18th century French Enlightenment.
Mm. I mean, someone else I often interview on the podcast, John Michael Greer, often writes about the myth of progress as the god of secular, so-called secular modernity. And I mean, just going off that, I mean, would you see that sort of belief that pessimism, in terms of it being the negative against optimism, you know, in that people are, that there's a frustration because people see that someone isn't believing in the god of the day, which is progress.
Yeah. And it again comes down to a question of the plausibility of an interpretive framework if we can't make definitive declarations about the validity of optimism or pessimism. We can certainly look around and have enough evidence to be skeptical about an unfettered notion of linear progress, and probably now even more so than in the 19th century. But they certainly already had that sense that not all is perfect in the world. And that's obviously a view that the 18th century philosoph shared absolutely as well. None of them, I don't think, are full-on apostles of reason or progress, but the way it became distilled and married to a certain instrumental notion of reason linked to technology and the belief that technologies, no ill effects. It certainly inspires a reaction against that in order to correct the course of the ship, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I mean, speaking about that course of the ship, just to stay with that metaphor, in your research for this book, and I guess amidst pessimism, in this sort of almost cultural, maybe not spontaneous, but cyclic rise, as we've spoken about time of pessimism as a movement or as an idea, is there almost a parallel ship of this very modern notion of happiness coming at the same time?
Yes. Absolutely, yes. The whole question of what happiness is, whether it's achievable, and whether it's an appropriate goal to be pursuing to begin with, or whether again the quest for happiness isn't itself one guarantee that you're never going to achieve that. So it becomes almost a structure of desire that depends on the impossibility of achieving that sort of happiness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's turn to one of the key figures, the key figure of pessimism, most definitely, and one of the key figures of your book, Arthur Schopenhauer. And I must say, I'll repeat myself, your reading of Schopenhauer was just so refreshing to me, because Schopenhauer is just constantly spoken about with these terms of, like, he was, he was the most miserable, annoying, all these little anecdotes of him. And I think, I'm going off the biography that I read was Zafransky's, which, and reading Schopenhauer's work himself, I was just so much in agreement with you in the way that you write about Schopenhauer's work, that there is humor there, there is tragedy, there is elements of comedy, and there's a sort of a bombastic nature to Schopenhauer, which I just, people rarely talk about. And when I read him, I don't want to say hope, but I don't think it's as miserable as, it's not miserable. And this just rarely gets seen. So I was so happy to see this. But what do you think is overlooked with Schopenhauer, and why do you pull these threads out? Why are these so important?
I think you're absolutely right that the humor is a key element in Schopenhauer. People would necessarily have to call his project a failed philosophical project if we're looking to account for a full system, right? A fully unified system that attempts to link metaphysics with ethics. His response to Kant and so on. But I think that is probably the wrong way to look at Schopenhauer, precisely because so many elements of pessimism that are articulated in his wake and generations after him are not systematic and are actually suspicious of those sorts of totalizing visions, precisely because they tend to shut down questions that are probably best left open and put in terms of dialogue. So I tend to read him not exactly as a literary author, but read him through techniques, you know, from literature on which he absolutely depends all the way through his writings, obviously in the aphorisms, but even in the more systematic expositions. He depends on metaphor. He depends explicitly on these sorts of genres that you mentioned, implotting life, to borrow that term, in terms of comedy or tragedy or both. And so he imposes an interpretive framework that he borrows from literary genres that allow us to then make sense of the world, not simply as raw experience anymore, but as experiences implotted in a larger framework that allows us to give them meaning. That's an important aspect of it to me, the way he, you know, very explicitly appeals to genres in terms of understanding human experience, and also the basic impossibility of his project. If the goal is complete renunciation, that is simply an impossible goal without actually ending human life, and he does argue against suicide. Complete renunciation is impossible. To live is to be endowed with some aspect of moving on. And so that generates to me an important notion that I talk quite a lot about in the book, the notion of living as if life had meaning, as if we could entertain the notion of renunciation and think about what that would mean. But even thinking about the consequences of renunciation, or, you know, thinking about its possibility or impossibility, already puts us solidly back in sort of the opposite of resignation, because that's that pushes thought forward.
Exactly. So by renunciation, you mean renouncing life, but not suicide specifically.
Right. Right. He does argue against suicide, precisely because it does nothing to cancel the effects of the will. So it is just yet another a flawed gesture. Mm.
See, now, I rarely push back against my guests. I rarely critique them. But one of my least favorite famous philosophical thoughts, ideas of all time is Camus with "We must imagine Sisyphus happy," which to me is just, okay, well, you just do what you want, just imagine him happy. That's just poor philosophy. It's lazy. How does that differ from "Well, we must live as if"? Because we have the same thing. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I had a conversation I recorded a couple of days ago on a book by Kevin Hart on contemplation, on religious contemplation, and he draws in Schopenhauer and says that Schopenhauerian liberation in terms of having that momentary liberation to the Platonic idea in art or aesthetics is sort of the secular equivalent of religious contemplation. But the problem is, as you've sort of said, is we end up back in the same problem, because sort of like, oh, this, you know, I'm liberated from the Kantian schema for a bit, but if I live as if, I know I'm going to fall back into that pendulum between suffering and boredom. So is as if just kind of a delusion? Is it? Are we lying to ourselves?
I would call it a lucid delusion. And again, this is where I would make appeal to fiction. It is an act of the imagination that actually does have an effect on the way we live. So that it actually breaks down the distinction between here I am in my imaginary world and here I am living in the world. So of activity and so on. So I guess the question then becomes, is it living in an illusion if you are in fact lucid about the illusion? If you're grasping onto to something that will allow you to give meaning to existence, is that full-on delusion, or is it an attempt to make meaning and to recognize that it is a completely constructed sense of meaning that you're, again, a plot that you're choosing to assign to either, you know, one's own existence or to a collective existence that would allow one to deal with the fact that renunciation is impossible. So I don't know if that answers your question.
So does the meaning of life become to avoid life?
It may. It may be.
But just staying on that line of as if. I mean, as if, you know, so was it Pascal, as if God existed? I don't think that was Pascal. I'm not sure. But to live as if, I mean, in that sense, someone said to live as if God existed. With the pessimistic worldview, what is it? Are we as if we were happy? As if there wasn't suffering? As if we weren't bored? What are our options?
Yeah, as if there could be the possibility of meaning. I think I would say. As if our actions in the world, in fact, could make a difference, whether or not they ultimately will. It's distinct, I think, from an act of faith, in that faith involves a certain level of trust and or especially hope that pessimism would not. And so it is not unlike 20th century existentialism in that sense, that you live not trusting that your actions will make a difference, or not hoping that things will turn out well, but to continue to act in the world with that constant interplay between the thinking and the acting, so that the thinking itself actually becomes a dynamic process. There in some ways can't be a definitive answer to the, you know, what would it mean to live as if, precisely because the thought is always circling back on itself in order to question the validity of one's presuppositions about whatever that might mean. And I think if we find, you know, the thing we are living for, or the you know exact way that we are going to live as if, we've already begun to shut down that sort of dynamism that I see in associated with views more akin to optimism or religious faith or even cynicism.
So as I was going to have a question there on that dynamism, it seems to be two options that, you know, one might be maybe someone's subjective worldview, they find God or something and that just shuts it down. Okay, I found my meaning. Often in the case if they're a pessimist, they're still going to have the niggle of doubt in relation to faith. But on the other side, could someone perhaps shut it down, just complete willful ignorance? You know what, life does have meaning, completely shut it down. But do you feel that this... this dynamism can ever be stopped?
I do think it shouldn't be stopped. Yeah. At any rate, I think that's where the ethical imperative of pessimism comes in, to keep those questions open, and to be open to new ways of thinking about things such as ignorance. Actually, one of the poets I look at in the book, Louise Ackermann, writes about ignorance in the neutral sense of simply not knowing, not you know, willful ignorance, but simply not knowing. For her, there's a double source of something associated with ignorance that really comes through in an affective dimension in her poetry. There is the not knowing, the simple quantity of things about the world we will never know, and so suffering from the curiosity about the world that is, you know, going to be infinitely unable to be satisfied. But then on the other hand, the suffering that comes from adjusting our perspective based on some of the things we know based on science. She was very much a reader of Darwin. And you know the absolute insignificance of human beings really made a strong impact on her. So there's the suffering that comes from knowing and from the development of scientific understandings of who we are and what sorts of, you know, creatures human beings are and our place in the universe, and also the infinite numbers of the things that we don't know. And so as lived experience develops and as human knowledge develops, I think the questions are going to become transformed in that sense, which is one of the reasons we can't shut that down into a definitive definition of what it would mean to live as if. Because if Darwin is right, then virtually everything we believe about our human importance in absolutely every aspect of everything about the world we've built, all of our art, all of our philosophy, all of that would crumble.
I mean, in psychology, for a brief time, also went that way with behaviorism of just an amalgamation of our own behaviors, of mechanical. So, I mean, I guess against that, to keep that dynamism going, is to fight against a mechanical, reasoned worldview.
At the same time, recognizing that the scientific mechanistic worldview may be ultimately, an accurate portrayal of the way things are. So there too, the verifiability and verisimilitude come into not conflict, but certainly they articulate two very different ways of understanding. That was the point. I borrow the notion of the as if from Vaihinger, who wrote that a notion of as if is an important motor of virtually all sorts of human discovery, including especially scientific discovery. To pursue truth as if it were attainable is a way to allow for the sorts of changes in perspective that scientific developments bring about. At the same time, none of us draws all the conclusions from things we know about, even though the reduction of emotion to a series of neurochemical reactions in the brain, at some level, that's a deeply unsatisfying explanation for the way we live life. And so what sorts of appeals can we make in a certain state of lucidity about the fictional nature of basic emotions such as love and attachment that will allow us to continue to live that way? I think that's an important contribution of pessimism that steers us away from a purely scientific version of nihilism.
Maybe it's a bit of Schopenhauer probably wouldn't like this question. Do you think love plays a key role somewhere along the line for the discussion around pessimism?
In as much as any sort of basic human experience does, again, the way we invent thought structures around a relationship with love, the way we experience art, the way we attempt to not necessarily remove ourselves from the everyday, but love is certainly one of those experiences that allows us to know a certain intensity of experience that would be akin to the aesthetic experience that Schopenhauer does write at great length about.
Mm-hmm. Out of interest, do you live as if?
I think I do. Yeah.
If you don't mind me asking, what's your as if? As if there's meaning?
As if there's meaning, yes. As if we weren't on a collision course to destroy the planet and all life on it. As if there were things to as if meaning were not just simply a structure of desire and some virtually unseizable object, but as if there were sort of guiding principles that allow us to carry on and to continue to create and to assign meaning and to think.
Mm-hmm. So your book revolves around the notion of modernity in relation to pessimism, and I just want to bring in this question because you sort of mentioned the predicament that modern humans find themselves in with the destruction of the Earth and many other crises that are ongoing. With respect to the, ironically, the progress of pessimism, with really its birth being written about in your book and then through to the modern day, do you think we need a, whether or not it's gone away in some sense, or at least maybe been pushed down, do you think a renaissance of pessimism would be actually healthy for our modern predicament? Well, still modern, but a different kind of modern.
I certainly do. It's most especially in that notion of limits, the notion of limits that suggests finite resources, that suggests that the endless accumulation of goods is totally unrelated to happiness, and in fact, inhibits notions of happiness, the adjustment of expectations in general, I think would lead to an ethic of caring, a certain awareness of global situations, global levels of happiness, and also an ethic of care for the planet. I think all these are very, very directly related to the notion of whether we, again, implot our experience as, you know, an infinitely expanding set of resources and an infinitely growing set of expectations about the world, or whether we can, you know, put those expectations into something, into a more narrow set of options that actually allows for satisfaction, if not happiness, for sure.
So is there something to be said that the idea that pessimism is truly a realism, but it's that the mass, the herd culture, if you to quote someone like Nietzsche, is really so potent that it has to be redefined from their perspective. But in truth, pessimism, my own personal pessimism seems to me of you know, I would love, you know, who wouldn't love to be optimistic about things, right? But time and time again, you're disappointed and eventually you're labeled as a pessimist. But to me, it just seems like an ongoing realism of pattern recognition. Maybe that sounds a bit Darwinian, but do you think there might be some truth to that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, one of the stereotypes that you hear people advancing about pessimists is that it's a reactionary point of view, that, you know, that no progressive politics can come out of that. And indeed, you know, if you look at the biography of a lot of the authors that I look at in the book, they were not necessarily political progressives, but, what I would claim is that progressive politics can, in fact, maybe even needs to come out of a certain notion of pessimism. A literary critic of later 19th century, Brunetière, defended pessimism by claiming that pessimism has to stem from a deep sense of dissatisfaction with the world as it is. And so you simply can't affirm the way the world is. And so from that absolutely stems the possibility of attempting to change it. And that's one aspect perhaps of the as if, you know, attempting to enact progressive political change in full awareness of the fact that, you know, political action tends to inspire reaction, and that all of this, you know, and any sort of political progress that might be made simply could fall into ruins based on whoever's next in power. But that's not to say that you simply resign yourself to the fact that things will never get better.
It's an interesting, so there's a quote that stood out for me, which you take from Rodenbach, and this is later on in your book. I want to believe and pray and keep quiet. And so this is in relation to faith, which is then in relation to pessimism. My original question was, you know, this quiet, this silence, is this the only way faith can really like keep pessimism at bay? But thinking about it now, it seems to me the way that actually modernity, so faith on the one hand, keep silent, keep in my prayer and contemplative prayer and with faith. But then on the other hand, thinking about what we've said about modernity, it seems actually the way modernity keeps pessimism at bay is to keep everything really noisy. So there seems to be a strange relationship pessimism has to silence. I mean, thinking back biographically to Schopenhauer, I mean, especially that's someone who adores silence. So do you think there's an importance of noise and silence and maybe sort of the inability of honest communication, I think, about what's going on there?
Yeah, I think I would distinguish between the noise of distraction that is inherent with modernity and that sort of dialogue that comes out of thinking and writing about pessimism. It's one of its paradoxes, maybe, that for authors who, you know, affirm withdrawal or silence or anything like that, pessimism has spawned an enormous set of literature, not unlike, you know, the text of Samuel Beckett, right? This endless proliferation of words about wanting to end communication or to end speaking or writing. So it's paradoxical, but I think that's precisely the aspect of dialogue, to again reinterpret and to not be satisfied with a particular meaning and to engage in that impossibility. In the, you know, Rodenbach, the poet you just quoted about wanting to, you know, believe and pray and keep quiet, he's essentially claiming something very similar to what Schopenhauer is claiming in terms of that desire for renunciation and the you know, the asking of the question of what it would mean to draw the consequences from the notion that that resignation is simply impossible.
A notion of resignation is impossible. You know, if we're to turn back to Schopenhauer, I don't want to insult the man, but maybe the modern world has gone against him here. What if we always push suffering away, which we seem to do in the modern world? You know, no one, if you're ill, tuck them away. If you're dead, quickly get the body away. We don't want to know anything about that. And on the other hand, no one seems to be bored anymore. We've always got something to do. So have we overcome the pendulum of Schopenhauer, or are we lying to ourselves?
Oh, I think we're absolutely lying to ourselves. Yeah. I mean, what we call meaningful engagement is often simply distraction or this endless proliferation of, you know, scrolling through social media or various websites, the thinking that we are, you know, filling that void. I think pessimism asks us to strip that away and to see what is beyond it, precisely because it is superficial. I think pessimism resists a certain notion of the superficial that, again, the modern world certainly encourages us to pursue in terms of distraction or consumer culture or mass media or any number of things to simply numb us. And then that's one of the roles of poetry that I discuss in the chapter on that, is precisely to put the notion of human suffering, you know, back within our consciousness, as you said, you know, whisk away the sick or the elderly. One of the poets I look at has a poem called, you know, L'Hôpital, the hospital, where he invites us, you know, as readers to, you know, take a tour of the human suffering present in any hospital.
Well, that's exactly what I was about to ask, is what would these, because we haven't touched too much on the poetry, and it does take it takes up, you know, a lot of your book. It's one of the big emphases. What would these poets, I mean, that's very broad, what would these poets of the 19th century France say we should do with boredom and suffering as the two pillars of Schopenhauerian, you know, the root of pessimism in a way, boredom and suffering, the things we can't avoid? What should we do with them in this, from this poetic sense?
Yeah, I think the poets and the novelists to some extent engage with the question of giving form to the experience of boredom and suffering, to craft a sense of both open-endedness and closure, right? The poetic form especially allows, you know, necessitates a certain closure, but at the same time, so many of the poems leave questions open. There are questions about suicide, for instance, in a poem about someone who's killed himself. The question is left open at the end, you know, given a life of interminable suffering, of which this person was, very well aware. Can we blame him? Can we seek to understand that experience? That notion of empathy, I think, comes through very much in the poetry, and a sense of affective engagement with suffering, but in a way that is mediated through the poetic form. So there's a sense of the lucidity that can come with, you know, the representation of these situations, and also perhaps the consolation of a sense of ending. It's in the poetry that especially the pronouncements about optimism or pessimism is precisely because we have no, you know, perspective beyond our own, to, you know, from which to evaluate human experience. Several poets, Jules Laforgue, Le Comte de Lille, represent the end of the world, the end of what they often will call it, a tragedy or a farce or both. Laforgue especially has a wonderfully ironic sense of a playful sense of tragedy, if you will. In their poems, we can in fact see a potential end to existence that through poetic form they invite us to see as comforting or perhaps desirable in ways that more abstract thought about these things might not allow us to.
So there's a certain freedom that comes from being pessimistic. Then, I mean, you mentioned Laforgue. Is it almost the idea of the right to be pessimistic?
Yeah, absolutely. The opening of that set of options, which of course, also provides a sense of freedom from toxic social constraints. Again, that almost taboo on admitting that you're not an optimist. The refusal to see pessimism as a social problem, but as a valid and perhaps helpful way of seeing the world.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain enjoyment as well of being, I must admit, there's a certain enjoyment of being pessimistic. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's morbid or...
Well, as the old joke goes, the pessimist is always very pleasantly surprised when things go well. And that's not to say things never go well, but it, again, prepares a set of expectations. Mm-hmm. Wanted to mention that one very interesting set of discourse in the nonfiction 19th century about pessimism, which was the sense of pessimism as a sickness. And I think this is still something that we still see, especially when we consider it as a social problem. The question became whether pessimists are simply sick people, mentally or intellectually or in any other way. For some, they were concerned about pessimism sort of infecting, becoming contagious and infecting large numbers of the population. For others, they said, no, pessimism is such a particular illness that only a small set of people will ever be drawn to this. So we don't need to think about it as a large scale social problem. But some of the most interesting texts actually put this in almost in the form of a question. There was a French statesman and a professor of literature named Charlemagne Lacour, who wrote a book that was eventually published after his death called Réflexion d'un pessimiste, Reflections of a Pessimist. When it was published, it was prefaced by the editor with a text that calls into question some of the things that that Charlemagne Lacour's reflections actually go on to affirm about whether this is a sick point of view. Pessimists themselves often said, they appeal to a quote that is very often attributed to Gérard de Nerval, a mid-century French poet. The attribution is apocryphal, but someone did say it in the 18th century that melancholy is a sickness that involves seeing the world as it is. Mm-hmm. And so going back to that notion of lucidity, do we want to label that a sickness, or does language work in such a way that sickness and health, the valences of sickness and health, are sort of reversed, and what we typically call sickness is in fact a kind of health? Charlemagne Lacour talks about people being pessimists being infected with the truth. So in that sense, is sickness really health, or do we want to affirm the value of a quote unquote sick perspective, not unlike the way fever alters our perspective so that we are aware of things that we're otherwise not aware of in our day-to-day reality. So is this sickness, is this health, or is this a particularly valuable form of sickness? And if so, what are the consequences for, again, large numbers of people adopting this view?
It certainly seems to be the modern problem as well. I mean, this is a fairly loaded topic, a fairly tough topic, but it's certainly the case, with cases of depression and anxiety on the rise, there isn't a more nuanced discussion of whether or not someone's personal character, personal temperament, is melancholic, which is not something that seems to be, should be, well, in my opinion, should be medicated away as something which is bad. Certainly, I'm not denying the reality of major depression or these mental illnesses, but there's certainly I think there's a more nuanced discussion to be had there about what is the overarching, we could say, philosophical ideology with regards to whether or not we're an optimistic or a pessimistic society, and whether or not that's being projected onto how people should be, and whether or not, you know, you can someone get better if their natural inclination is to say, well, you can keep trying to tell me to see things this way, you can keep doing, I don't know, CBT mind maps, think yourself happy. But if that's not how reality is, that seems to be a dangerous predicament to put people in.
Absolutely, yes. There is, you know, as you say, without wanting to romanticize depression in any way, I think if you look at the world we've created for ourselves and are depressed by it, I think that's an absolutely lucid and well-justified way to see the world. And so the question that is not unlike what we were talking about earlier in terms of a lucid delusion. How can we adjust our view of the world so as to live in it without abandoning the sense of why we might, you know, be disposed to seeing the world as a valid source of depression in terms of the world we've created, the way things might have been different, the way they aren't, and the collision course that we seem to be on in terms of destroying ourselves, destroying any sense of meaning, destroying the planet. It's easy to see why depression and also, you know, panic seem to be the two poles of reaction to the world, either, you know, on their own or in combination.
Do you think the time's fast coming where pessimism will once again be a realism? Be accepted a bit more?
I hesitate to make predictions. I'm guessing not. The pandemic, for at least a moment, in so many other ways, and people talk about the ways in which the pandemic showed us the way things might have been different in terms of the way we value certain kinds of labor, in terms of the access we have to healthcare or not, and questions of racial injustice and questions of gender and so on. I think the pandemic also pointed us toward a way in which we can, in fact, say we're not okay, right? If people say, "How are you doing?" "Great," was often, again, probably more so in U.S. culture than in other parts of the world, I think. But that sort of default to "I'm going to pretend to be happy," and "I'm going to pretend that things are going really well when they're not." At least for the pandemic moment, I think people were more open to the fact that, you know, things are going at best okay. I haven't been infected with a disease that's going to kill me yet.
But then, I guess, pessimistically speaking, it was quite astounding how quickly we springed straight back into our quote-unquote normal way of being after all the lockdowns and pandemics.
Absolutely, yes, because people were very eager, right, to get back to the normal, despite all of the warnings that maybe the normal wasn't the best way to go about. Maybe that was a moment of potential change. Mm.
What is it you'd like people to take from your book?
Well, certainly a sense of the importance of literature and poetry and novels, especially in terms of the way they interact with our imagination and the way that they're not separate from our lived reality, but a key aspect of the way we form our reaction, not just our reaction to our experiences, but the way we actually understand what those experiences are. A sense of the, you know, continued relevance of the 19th century to our own questions of a sense of continuity between that world and our own. A willingness to give pessimism a chance again as something that can be in fact productive of a life that we might affirm is worth living, a certain sense of caution in the face of optimism, or a certain sense of suspicion in terms of, you know, the way we understand the world and the way that may involve a whole lot of blinders that we put up collectively to our perception of the way the world is. So those are some of the things that I hope people will take from it.
Is there anything key you'd, within your book that you feel you'd like to add in, or that we've missed that you feel is important?
We covered a lot. Mm-hmm. So
Okay. What are you working on now? Because I believe you is it a was your latest book the one on Chiron and Adorno? Is that the one that's coming?
There's one that's a well the book I published after the pessimism book was on Adorno and Baudelaire. Reading Baudelaire with Adorno, notions of subjectivity and dissonance. Later in 2024, I have a book called Thought as Experience, and that deals with Bataille, Cioran, and Clément Rosset. And then I'm currently back at work on Baudelaire and his portrayal of objects, building a little bit on the Baudelaire Adorno book. And then I'm going to get back to music, which is one of my other great passions. Haven't written a book-length study of music in quite a while. Had something on Proust and music from maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but I'm looking forward to getting back more directly to the relations of literature and music, which were my first love academically.
I see. Well, I would love to discuss Cioran and Bataille and thought his experience of you when that's released. But I'll be sure to put links for Living Well with Pessimism in 19th Century France in the description below. But yeah, unless there's anything else you'd like to add.
An excellent chance to talk about things. You have these wonderful questions, and it was a real pleasure to have this dialogue.
Well, Joseph Auguste, thanks very much.